WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What inspires a young computer wizard to use his skills to break into computer systems? My guest John Lee was a member of the Masters of Deception, a notorious gang of hackers. He's one of the people profiled in the new book, Masters of Deception, which we discussed in the first part of our show. Along with other members of his gang, he was convicted of conspiracy and computer trespass for breaking into computer systems. The authors of Masters of Deception write, "These boys were charged with the most widespread intrusions ever recorded of the nation's largest and most sensitive computer systems. The government decided to make an example of these teenagers." John Lee pled guilty, was sentenced to a year in prison, and served 6 months. Lee grew up in the inner-city neighborhood of Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, New York, where he was once a member of a street gang. He claims to have broken into more than 25,000 computer systems. I asked him what he would do once he got in.
First of all, when I break into a system, we used to have, like, we kind of had, like, a mental checklist. Like, when you go into a system, first you, obviously, you rate its importance. You check out, you know, who owns the computer, what that company does. Then you go check, you know, what other companies are related to this company, and how could this, you know, computer, you know, what's up with this computer? And then, like, you might find out what other computers that this computer is, you know, connected to. And then you might go through the system and find stuff out. Now, if the system was something that I had never messed with before, obviously I'm not going to really... I never, like, damaged the system, but, like, there was two type of systems. Some of them you would just look at everything, and other ones you would just use to actually program, you know, because a lot of times I would program stuff when them, you know, because I didn't have access to, like, you know, expensive $1 million mainframes, mm-hmm. like a Cray or something like that. So, you know, I'd have to, like, borrow time to learn how to use them and program them, you know, maybe run a little program in the background who's going to mind, you know, and, you know. And stuff like that. So it was definitely, you know, but there was other computers that we pretty much just looked at, absorbed the information that was in it, you know, just for curiosity's sake, and then just pretty much left it alone. Maybe every once in a while, we might tamper with something, and that would be to just, like, make sure we could always log in, and that would, like, be, you know, modify whatever, you know, modify it in a way that, you know, was invisible to all the users, so it wouldn't affect them in any way, but allowed us access always. And I'm sure that there's, like, you know, I'm sure there's, like, at least, like, 5,000 systems out there that probably are still, like, got those back doors in them, unfortunately.
Would you ever leave your mark just so people would know that you'd been there?
I personally never have done that, but I remember a couple of times we set up, like parasite bulletin boards sometimes on them. And they were basically like enclaves where, you know, it was like enclaves where people, you know, hackers would just get on there and stuff and, you know, talk and chat and stuff on, you know, on somebody else's computer. And the reason they would, you know, and it would just be cool because it'd be like such an accomplishment that you could do it. And, you know, sometimes we would, like, you know, break into, like, computers, like, here in the USA, and then maybe another one in England, and then maybe another one in South Africa. And then, like, network them, like, practice networking them and have, like, a network BBS from across the world and stuff like that, all on other people's computers, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, just cool, clever stuff, really, you know. But it depends on the computer, because some computers obviously can help you hack into other computers. So it was kind of like your power used to grow exponentially, because our power base grew exponentially after we took over every single regional Bell operating company in the country. Because at that point, we could monitor any phone line in the country, and basically, there was no need for hacking at that point, because you can see everything.
Did you have a personal code about what kind of breaking in was acceptable and what wasn't?
Yep. I felt that, that, like, any computer was fair game, and I felt that hacking was illegal. However, it was just that I was just really good at it, but there was some limits, and one of the limits was, like, credit fraud and, like, toll fraud. I tried to avoid those things at all costs. I did avoid credit fraud. I never really, because I felt as we moved toward a creditless society, I mean, a moneyless society, and, you know, that's based on credit. You know, there's a lot of services that are offered with that, and a lot of those services wouldn't be available if the credit, if credit was undermined. And, you know, by doing, you know, damaging other people's credit is usually the small guy that gets hurt. You know, the average person, you know, like even like somebody like my mom could get, you know, affected by credit fraud and have to shell out bucks. So that's why I always stayed away from those sort of things. But like just the pure, you know, challenge of breaking into computer systems and learning how to program them and programming them and operating them, you know, to their full capacity is was stimulating.
How did you learn about computers?
Oh, I learned about computers because I got lucky. Because my mom's is a school teacher, and she had a friend there who was into computers, like had an old Apple. And, you know, when I would come there after school, she would let me play with it and touch it and, you know, mess with it. It was kind of clever.
So how old were you when you got your own computer?
It's kind of way back, but I think it was like around 12, maybe. Maybe a little bit. Yeah, 12. 12. I did get a Commodore 64 at 12.
How did you cobble together enough sophisticated equipment to become a hacker?
Well, the funny thing is that you don't need sophisticated equipment. You only need a dumb terminal. You just need a monitor and a keyboard and a modem, which doesn't require like a hard drive or anything like that. Because when in the beginning, I never had those things. And then when I did have enough money to get them, I didn't need them because all I did was really like hack and stuff. So you don't really need sophisticated equipment. You can get a dumb terminal from Radio Shack for like maybe $10, and then a follow up a modem for maybe another couple of bucks, and then you're straight.
Now, I read about you that you actually like scavenged a lot of equipment.
Oh yeah, sure.
How'd you find it? Where would you go?
I mean, sometimes you'd see it thrown out from like telephone companies and universities and stuff, or sometimes, you know, someone would sell something for really cheap. You might buy it, but most of the time, you know, you can scrounge it up and they're like throwing it out and they don't realize that they could possibly fix it. I know that there's like several companies now that do stuff to, you know, they ask corporations for those computers they're going to throw out and refurbish them. And, you know, I guess they give them to schools and stuff like that.
My guest is John Lee. He used to be a member of a gang of computer hackers called Masters of Deception. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former computer hacker John Lee. Can you tell me about the first time that you actually broke into a computer system? How you got in, what it felt like to you?
That's a good feeling. I remember the first time I dropped in after breaking into a system. It felt so good. It was sort of like a real good back rub, like on the verge of like orgasmic pleasure. I don't know how to explain it. It was like a tingly feeling all over. And, well, I hope nobody else gets addicted. It's very addictive because it's funny. The first time it's like that. I did get numb all over. And, you know, and of course it was almost like a drug because eventually as I broke into computers, you know, I kept searching for new highs, you know, more challenging computers. So I had to, you know, eventually just try to break into everything, looking for that magic high the first time.
Now, how did you find other hackers?
Most of the time, sometimes you'd meet them in the weirdest places. You know, you would just be like somewhere, you know, messing with a computer and, you know, they'd come along and, you know, you'd talk. And then eventually, you know, you'd find out, you know, like kind of how, you know, they felt about certain issues. And then next thing you know, you probably reveal your identities to each other. And then, you know, there's other situations where I've run into computer hackers on like systems. Like I remember one time I met this kid on a system from Japan, and he was like a hacker, and he had like never met any other computer hackers, and like, you know, he was like Japanese, and he was like kicking it and stuff, and he was mad cool, and he was pretty good too, and you know, became friends and stuff like that, and strictly met on like this system that we had both hacked, you know.
You were in the Masters of Deception.
This is true.
A gang in cyberspace. Did you know each other only from speaking online, or did you meet together geographically too?
At first, we just used to meet online. Then eventually, we met in person. I mean, we met in so many, it's hard to say because we met in so many different ways, like just overlapping. Like I remember I had changed high schools, and so did Fiber Optic, Mark Abene, and we wound up at the same alternative high school in Manhattan. And it was just, you know, complete, I mean, that was just complete, you know, who could imagine that we would just meet like that, you know? And then, but I had met him before that. It's just that I had never met him in person. And of course, then we became like friends and stuff at the time.
You were busted by the Secret Service with the help of telephone company investigators. Did you expect that you would eventually be discovered?
Well, the funny thing is we knew that they were coming for like months on end, due to like secret documents that they provided for us, you know? Well, they didn't know they were providing them, but we knew. But it was like, you know, it was like we all had to make a decision whether, you know, we wanted to do this for the rest of our lives. Did we want to go on the run and just do this forever? Or did, you know, never see like my moms again or something like that? Or should we just sit there and wait for them to come? And, you know, obviously the decision was made to just say, well, you know, they're coming, so.
So you pled guilty.
Mm-hmm.
You were, correct me if I'm wrong, you were sentenced to a year, spent 6 months in prison.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like in prison?
Well, I went to boot camp, so it was kind of, you know, like, you know, that paramilitary stuff, you know. I was like squad leader, like I was team leader, so, you know, I got to march everybody around. Oh, team! So it was kind of clever, but we had no TV and no newspapers and...
No computers, probably.
No computers.
Do you feel like you were changed by the prison experience?
No, because I'd already changed before I went in. Because, like, with most federal cases, a lot of times you actually don't go to jail for the crime till like, a couple of years later. Like, in this case, it was, like, 2 years later. And, like, I had enrolled... I was in college and had done, like, tons of community service stuff, not because of the case, but just because I was doing it and just like doing like positive stuff. And then I got yanked to jail. That happened to all of us, actually. We all had started to do positive stuff and then we got sentenced. And I don't think the judge took that into account. He just said, yo, you guys got to go.
So you've served time for doing something illegal, but the thing that you did that was illegal, you were able to do because you're really gifted and really smart about computers. So when you're, say, in the job market or something, and I'm not sure if you have been or not, but I wonder what the balance is of scorn that you get because you did something illegal and praise and interest because you're obviously really gifted.
After I got busted, but before I got sentenced, you know, I went for a computer job interview and I'd fill out they'd have like a little exam and the guy would come back and he would say, you know, you scored better than guys who've come in here with like 20 years experience or like master's degrees in computer science. And he'd say, but guess what? You don't even have a degree or anything. I can't give you this job. I just can't, you know, pass this through personnel. There's no way they're going to hire you, even though I'll give you my full recommendation. I wouldn't get hired, you know. And these were like $50,000 jobs and stuff. And, you know, I mean, I even tried before I got busted. And, you know, they kind of acted funny and stuff. So, you know, because I think they kind of figured that we were probably, you know, between our age and no degree, they probably figured that we were hackers or something like that. I'm not sure. But that happened. And then recently now, when I go on, like, I do, like, lecturing and stuff like that about computer hacking, and I might go somewhere to, like, a company, and they never let me near their computers. I went to, like, some company, like, refuse to let me, like, even in the room with them. They don't want me to see anything. And some people might think it's flattering, but I kind of think it's insulting to think that, you know, even to today, that just me being in the room, that I would try to do something.
Do you ever get harassed online now?
Who, me? Mm-hmm. Why? I don't understand. Why would I get harassed?
Well, I don't know. I thought maybe there are people who still feel they have debts to pay.
I'm glad that I guess the Master Deception, we've reached a certain level of respect that, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, someone won't come along better than us or anything like that, But like I said, I don't think anybody can really touch what we've done. Like the Masters of Deception and like Deepak will rule forever. Like it's like a legend type thing. And, you know, I mean, it's a grudging respect, I admit, from even our enemies, like maybe like some of the enemies we've made in the past. But, you know, I'd like to say, you know, I'm sorry.
Do you still see the people who are in the Masters of Deception?
Well, legally, we're not supposed to see or talk to each other. So I guess that precludes any sort of meeting.
John Lee is a former member of the computer hacker gang Masters of Deception. He's one of the people profiled in the new book, Masters of Deception. This is Fresh Air.